there is a logical connection between our last topic, the proclamation of the kingdom of God in Jesus' ministry, and the next one, that is the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount is the ethic of the kingdom. It describes the way we live if we are under the reign or living in the kingdom of God. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is presented rather logically at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, the beginning of his public ministry. It takes place, says Matthew, after Jesus returned to Galilee. That implies that Jesus was elsewhere. As we said last time, he was having a quiet ministry, a few healings and a few encounters with people in the south. And then he returned to Galilee, determined to begin his ministry there. We have a couple of themes already identified that connect as well with the ethic of the kingdom. The one is the identity of Jesus. Jesus is the King of the Jews, the Son of David, Emmanuel, one greater than John, the beloved Son. And he is also the King, the one who comes proclaiming the rule of Christ. Second, there is the theme of conflict established as well. Herod has attempted to kill Christ. And as we see over in the Gospel of Luke, there's also the reception Jesus gets at his first sermon. He's going to be cast off a cliff at the end of the message. So not everyone is listening with favor to what Jesus has to say. But when he does speak, he speaks to those who are even, we might say, the least likely. He begins with those who are in Galilee, the ones who are, as we've seen perhaps, highly Hellenized. I showed you before, I will show you again, the influence of Hellenism. There's a synagogue. Looks like a Greek building. Everywhere you go, you see things that look Greek, that look pagan, because that's what it was. It was a pagan land in many, many ways. Not fully, but largely. Galilee of the Gentiles. Galilee was also not only a place of spiritual poverty, but a place of physical poverty. Jesus began his ministry among the poor. He came to pronounce, as we'll see later, the gospel for the poor, release for the captives. Now, you may not see that so clearly right away in the Gospel of Matthew, but you have to realize that when Jesus healed people, when he healed the diseased, the paralyzed, the demonized, he was healing poor people. There was no health care system. If you were paralyzed, I guarantee you were poor. Maybe a very few exceptions. If you were born to a very wealthy family, there were not many wealthy families. If you were demon-possessed, if you were gravely ill, you didn't have much. Jesus began his ministry not with the upper middle class, not in the safe suburbs, but he began his ministry with the poor. That's where he turned first. The people came to him in throngs. They were drawn by his miracles. They were attracted by them, and they also thought that it must mean that he's not just a miracle worker, but as even Nicodemus said, we know that you're a teacher from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you are doing if God were not with him. So they came to Jesus because he alleviated their pain. But they also came because they thought this must be, or at least it may be, something much, much more. But Jesus never intended to heal all the sick of Israel. In fact, on a number of occasions, he leaves people who are sick to go on and do something else. His goal was to introduce people to the reign of God. We might say that his healings garnered their attention. But then once he got it, he moved on to other things. What we need to do for a little while tonight is to think about how we should read, how we should understand the Sermon on the Mount as a whole. What the Sermon on the Mount as a whole is a description of life in the kingdom. Now, it says, if you look at chapter 5, verse 1, that when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. And his disciples came to him, And he began to teach them, saying, to whom did Jesus speak? He spoke to his disciples. And that's crucial for understanding the Sermon on the Mount. He did not come just to teach absolutely anybody. He separated out those who were his disciples, or maybe more likely, those who were interested in becoming his disciples or interested in taking the first steps toward being a disciple. And he spoke to them. Let me keep going for a little while. I see a hand. There are other views of this matter, and there are qualifications to be made. There are a variety of ways of looking at the Sermon on the Mount, and it's partly because the Sermon on the Mount is a difficult piece of the Bible to read. Do you agree with me on that? Do you disagree with me on that? In one way, the Sermon on the Mount is the easiest thing in the world to read. I mean, you just read it. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Well, that's clear, isn't it? You are the salt of the earth. Do not murder. Not only don't murder, don't be angry with your brother. Easy to read. Absolutely clear. Don't do these things. Do those other things. What's the problem? Why is it difficult to read? Because it's so clear. That's why. There's no mistaking it. You can't explain it away. There it all is. And it's impossible. What people wrestle with is not the content of it, not the excellence, not the clarity. What they wrestle with is the impossibility of it. See, we'd be happy if Jesus had said simply, don't murder, and let it go at that. But he doesn't. He says, don't murder. Furthermore, don't be angry with anybody. Furthermore, if somebody else is angry at you, you go be reconciled to them. Furthermore, if somebody's suing you, go be reconciled to them. It just keeps getting worse and worse. In fact, it gets all the way to the point that he says, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now, that's when we know we're in trouble. And that's when you need a theologian or a pastor or a preacher or a book of Bible information to come along and tell you, well, you see, that word perfect is the word teleos, and that word really means mature or complete. So you don't really have to be perfect, see? But then I say, that's a big relief. Because I don't have to be perfect as my Father in heaven is perfect. I only have to be as mature as he is. And as complete as he is, and that's so much easier for me. The problem with the Sermon on the Mount is not that we can't understand it, we can't do it, we can't live it. And so people have tried to find ways to understand this very, very difficult body of teaching. And I want to run through them with you just briefly. In the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church said, this is a description of the councils of perfection. That is to say, it's for those who aspire to a higher level of righteousness, like the monks, who take the vows of chastity and poverty and obedience. They don't get married for the sake of the kingdom. And they sell all their possessions and give to the poor. Most people can't handle that. But for those who can, Sermon on the Mount. Technical term, two-tiered ethic. One for the ordinary Christian, another for the super-Christian. Martin Luther, said a couple things about it, actually. The first thing he said is, this applies to Christians in their private life, but not their public life. In our private life, we turn the other cheek. But some Christians are magistrates, and there you can't turn the other cheek. There you have to slap the other cheek. And so, as individuals, yes, personally, our personal piety, I'm simplifying greatly here, forgive me, those of you who are Lutherans. If there are any Lutherans here, I know I'm simplifying. But in our secular life, in our personal spiritual life, yes, but in our secular life, no. We don't turn the other cheek, we may have to lift up a sword. The Anabaptists of the Reformation and others who take the Bible very literally say, this is just something you have to do. And if it means you have to leave the world to do it, then leave the world. If it means radical pacifism, then radical. If it means never entering military service or never entering the judicial branch of your society or never taking an oath, so you can never enter the army for that reason either, or not taking an oath when you're in a court case, or not taking an oath entering government that way, then you just have to leave all the government. Take it very literally. World flight, some people would call it. Some later Lutherans, and a lot of people since then, have thought it was a good idea, believe that the goal of the Sermon on the Mount is to drive us to despair. And I know it could sound funny, but I don't really mean it as a joke. It drives us to the gospel. You read it, you say, woe is me, I am undone. And you read on, and you read on, and at the end of the story, the Christ who said, do all these things, dies for our sins, and then rises. And that's the solution to the Sermon on the Mount. There's a lot of truth in that. I don't think it's the whole truth, but I think it's a big part of the truth. Of course, there are some people who say, as one of our presidents, Harry Truman, said, I'm a Christian in the sense, this isn't a quote, but many people say, I'm a Christian in the sense that I follow the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount. Now, I'd say they're probably being presumptuous. But what they mean is, those parts of it that are accessible to me that I can accomplish, I'll try to, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And don't hate other people. And don't resist an evil person if you can help it. Be peaceable. I think that there's some truth, especially in the view, the Lutheran view, that it drives us to Christ. But I think it's also true that there are clues in the text as to the riddle about how to take the Sermon on the Mount. And the chief clue is something we've already read. It's in Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. To whom is the Sermon on the Mount given? It is given to disciples. Therefore, the view that it's only for super Christians can't be true, because it's given to anybody who is sitting listening. And the view that it's simply a moral standard we should go try to obey isn't valid, because it's for people who know they can't obey. It's for people who acknowledge Christ as their Lord and King. That's who it's for. It's not for people who hope to get in. It's for people who are in. Now, the qualification is very important, and that qualification is in Matthew chapter 7, verse 28. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, so just so we're not simplistic here, it's not simply for disciples. It's primarily or essentially or truly for disciples. At the very end of it, the very end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus finishes, 28, and it says the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their scribes. Now, what does that mean? It means that if the Sermon on the Mount is taught by the Sea of Galilee, and there's a probable place, which I've visited, where it actually took place, it's on a sloping hill. And so Jesus probably went to the Mount and called his disciples. But, if he's speaking loudly and there are thousands of people, some other people are going to start to filter in. And they're going to listen in. It's not really for them. But Jesus is not going to say you can't listen. It's a little bit like a pastor who preaches on the life of discipleship, and he may say, you may have heard this, I have, and I've said it. If there's anybody in this place that's not a Christian, some of this won't make sense. But if you want to listen in to hear what it's like to be a Christian, by all means, listen in. You don't say it exactly that way, but sometimes you say, look, this is not an evangelistic situation. But if you want to listen, go ahead. You've all experienced something like this. You're at the Thanksgiving table, and the seating arrangement is done, and you are seated next to Aunt Griselda and Uncle Ned. And Uncle Ned, I hope there's nobody in this room, Uncle Ned is an actuary. And Uncle Ned is going to tell you what the probability is that you're going to die in the next 3 years. And what the probability is that you're going to die in the next 10 years, and what impact that has on your life insurance plan. And Aunt Griselda collects something. I don't know what it is, but you're not interested in it. At the other end of the table, there's a conversation going on about the football game, right? You're very interested in that, but it's 14 people away. And you're next to Ned and Griselda, and that's who you're supposed to talk to. Your ear is not supposed to be down there, but it is. You're listening in. Now, that's the way it was. An unbeliever can listen in. It's fine. But properly speaking, it is not for them. Properly speaking, it's for disciple. Now, why do I say that? I say it because of chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. I also say it because there are many other clues that Jesus was speaking to disciples. It begins by addressing people who know their need of grace. Blessed are the poor. The first beatitude makes no sense to a secular person. The second beatitude, blessed are those who mourn, really makes no sense. What does it mean to mourn? Sad, weeping, wailing? What does it mean to be blessed? You know what the Greek word, original word, is? Happy. So happy are those who mourn. Happy are those who cry. That makes no sense to a secular person. We understand happy are those who mourn about the right things. Happy are those who mourn about sin, who mourn about injustice, who mourn about sin in their own life, sin in the world, right? We understand that it is better to mourn over sin than to be indifferent to it. There is a blessedness in grieving over your own sin. It is far better, far more blessed, to grieve over your own sin than to gloat over your own sin. It is far more blessed to grieve over your own sin than to be indifferent to your sin and say, get off my case, leave me alone, I'm only human. It is far better to grieve over abortion than it is to be indifferent to abortion. Blessed are those who mourn. But it takes spirituality to understand or to discern that. So the Sermon on the Mount makes sense to those who have spiritual discernment. It also is for those who know God as their King and their Father. We're supposed to pray, Our Father. Who prays Our Father? Believers. Sermon on the Mount is given to those who fast and pray and give alms to the poor. It doesn't say if you fast, it says when you fast. It doesn't say if you pray, it says when you pray. It doesn't say if you give to the poor, it says when you give to the poor. Who does those things? Believers. They're the marks of a believer. They're some of the marks, it's not the only mark. In the custom of Jesus' day, in the culture of Jesus' day, those were the three marks of a pious person. And Jesus is interacting with their conception of what a pious person is. So the Sermon on the Mount is essentially for believers. Crowds can listen in, but essentially it's for those who know God and who know the life of the kingdom. It's for people who want to live under the reign of Christ. It's for those who are interested in that command that Jesus gives. Your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Only a believer is interested in that. Remember, this was not an easy thing, right? To exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees would be to exceed the righteousness of the most holy people around. So there, too, it's only those who are interested in the reign of Christ. Furthermore, the Sermon on the Mount invites us to pattern our lives after Christ. And who is truly able to pattern their life after Christ? Listen to what Jesus says a little bit later. He says, in a key verse for understanding Matthew, Matthew 10, 24 and 25, he says, it is enough for a servant to be like his master. We're going to talk about that verse later on. A crucial verse. It is enough for a servant to be like his master. I would say, if you think about your aspirations, would you agree that it would be enough to be like your master, to be like Christ? If you look at the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, the description of the blessed person, what you have is a description in large measure, not a perfect description in every regard, but in large measure, a description of Christ. Think with me, follow with me through Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to skip the first one. We'll come back to it last because it's maybe the most problematic. Blessed are those who mourn. Didn't Jesus mourn over Israel? Didn't he mourn over them like sheep without a shepherd? Didn't he mourn over their rebellion? Didn't he say, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I've longed to gather you under my wings like a hen gathers his chicks, but you would not have it. and now your desolation is upon you. He mourned over their sin and rebellion. And so blessed are we if we are Christ-like, if we are servants like our Master. Blessed are the meek. Wasn't Jesus meek? Didn't he say, or humble, same word in the Greek, didn't he say, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, for I will give you rest, for my yoke is easy, my burden is light. And how does it continue? For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. So if we live the Sermon on the Mount, we are living a Christ-like life. The fourth beatitude, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Surely Christ hungered and thirsted for righteousness. He was righteous. He was perfectly righteous. And he not only hungered for himself, but he hungered for us, that we should be righteous too. How hungry was he? He was so hungry that he was baptized, even though there was no ground for him to be baptized, to fulfill all righteousness, to make it clear beyond a shadow of a doubt that everything a righteous person would do, he would do. He offered, you know, he went to the temple. He went to the synagogue. He prayed faithfully. The next beatitude, blessed are the merciful. Surely that's a description of Christ. If you ask the question, why did Jesus perform his miracles? Do you know what the answer to that is? Why did the gospel say that Jesus performed his miracles? What's the explanation given? Moved with compassion, half a dozen times, saw the blind man, saw the crippled man, moved with compassion, laid his hands, went over to them, called them to himself. Blessed are the merciful, because they participate in the life of Christ, the Master. Blessed are the pure in heart is the next beatitude. Surely Christ is pure in heart. He even was willing to say, who of you convicts me of any sin? That's a bold statement to make. I'll never make that statement. Unless I want the answer, me. Which, of course, would come rapidly. In fact, he was so pure that when he said that, it's in John, seems like there was no answer. And if you turn to Matthew chapter 26, you can see a small indication of that. Matthew chapter 26, verses 59 and 60. Says that when Jesus was on trial, and they're trying, of course, to find some cause to execute him, they're looking for false evidence, because there's no true evidence. They're looking for false evidence against him so they could put him to death, but they could not find any, even though they brought many false witnesses forward. Now, you have to understand what's happening here. They want to stay, as one wise theologian has said, just inside the tortured bounds of legality. It's not my phrase, it's somebody else's. They want to achieve just the veneer of legality, just the veneer that we're doing the right thing. And so they've got to come up with some charge that's plausible. And they'll bring anybody in, as long as it's close, that's good enough, and they can't do it. They can't find one person who can even make a plausible charge. They themselves, even though they're bound on convicting Christ, have to throw out all the evidence. And the only way they finally get him is when they ask him, are you the Christ? And he says, yes. Pure in heart. No one could convict him of sin. Blessed are the peacemakers. Well, it's true that Christ came to bring not peace but a sword, because he did not come to bring peace at any price. Although peace is a wonderful thing, to this day we don't pursue peace no matter what. There is a time to fight. But essentially, wasn't Christ a peacemaker? I mean, first of all, he brought peace between mankind and God, above all. But he certainly also brought peace to people's souls, to people's hearts. And testimony throughout the ages of him making peace between former enemies and members of families and people of different backgrounds and all sorts of prejudices and stresses that Christ has overcome. Blessed is the peacemaker. And of course, blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Surely that is a description of Christ. The only thing that's not quite clear, perhaps, is whether the very first beatitude describes Jesus. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I'm not sure that he was poor in spirit, because to be poor in spirit means to know your own spiritual poverty, your own spiritual deficit. And he didn't know that. But I will say that he understood poverty in spirit. He understood that he ought to come to the poor first. Didn't start with the wealthy and the powerful and the prominent in Judea. He started with the poor, the blind, the crippled in Galilee. And he gave himself, I think most gave himself to the nobodies and the nothings and the outcasts of this world. Not that he was prejudiced or would have nothing to do with the rich, but he gave himself first to others. Let me pause right there. And I had two questions I put off. The first is John's, and then I put you off a while ago. Answer. Okay. The question or the comment is, I view poverty in spirit as absence of self-assertion, and that is absolutely true. Dependence on God, not demanding your own way. That is true. What I'll say is, you'll hear my nuance next week when we talk about it a little bit more, but I am with you. What I really should have said, and what I believe, pardon me, is that he had most, if not all, sides of poverty in spirit. He didn't have the side of knowing his own deficit. He lacked that self-interest. So that was your point, too. Probably some other people were thinking the same thing. I've taught what you just said, I have taught publicly, so I definitely agree with you. I just didn't say it right then, yes. There's a couple things. It's a very good question. The question is, how can we... You're kind of saying, I see blessed are the poor and those who mourn. We'll talk about that more later. But how can it possibly be that you would be happy to be persecuted? Well, one thing is, when the kingdom of the world opposes you and persecutes you, it shows that they recognize you as one of Christ's. And if you are one of Christ's, as Jesus says, theirs is the kingdom. Now, that's blessedness. That's one. I think we can also say that we can just go a little bit farther down. Another reason why we should be blessed if we're persecuted and insulted is because in the same way they persecuted the prophets who went before you. What he's saying is, you're making a difference in the world. And when you make a difference in the world, it's painful at times. It brings opposition. It brings heavy burdens. It may bring persecution. It may bring, maybe in our society today, it just brings people asking you to do a lot of things and you have no leisure, and that's maybe not so pleasant. But you're making a difference in the world. And there's a blessedness in that, that the world recognizes the difference you make. Well, those are good questions. So I see one more. I'll take one more, and then I'm going to set up your assignment for next time. Go ahead. That could be part of it, too. Yes. The question is, can poverty in spirit be dependence upon God? And yes, although again, remember, he's not dependent on God. The reason why I say it's a little bit tough is because he's not dependent on God exactly the same way we are. Because we're dependent on God for salvation. Jesus wasn't. You're all kind of, you're saying, gee, Dr. Duran is not sure how number one works, and we have some ideas. And that's true. I'm just trying to say that this is one where there's a little more difference. Nonetheless, here's my main point in this. The Sermon on the Mount is for disciples, for believers, whose aspiration is to be like their master. And when you look at the description of it, what you find is the description of the blessed character is a description of Christ, who is the goal of our life. Now, I say that I want to set up what we're doing, what you're doing, for next week just a little bit. The Beatitudes... The Beatitudes are a funny list. We've already talked about how odd one of them is, blessed are those who mourn, but they're funny in other ways too. Happy are those who are poor, happy are those who mourn. That's one funny side of it. Another funny side of it is, are these the traits that you would list if you wanted to list a blessed character or person? I mean, forget the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 for a minute, okay? List the traits that you wish you had, or list the traits you wish you had in a friend, or in a neighbor, or your coworker right next to you, or if you like it, the traits you wish your children had. What would be ordinary? Now, don't tell me I wish they would mourn, because that's nobody says that. I've asked many people, what do you hope for your children? Nobody's ever said, I hope they know how to mourn. Most parents, if you ask them, would say, I would hope they would mourn less. We call that whining. And crying. All right, what would you seek? What character traits do you admire in yourself, your others, your friends, your children? Yes. Okay, the fruit of the Spirit. But now that's good. But I'm going to go sort of one by one. I heard somebody say honesty. I'm just going to list a few. Honesty. Humility. Say it again.
Dependable.
Yes. I'm going to take professorial prerogative and say reliable. Just one letter shorter. What else? Okay, compassionate. I'll put that. I heard somebody else have compassion. Somebody else said love. They're related to each other.
Character.
Trustworthy.
Character.
Character in general. I mean, like rectitude, dignity, that kind of stuff. I'll put that up there. Dignity. What was the one over here? Trustworthy. Dignity, integrity, trustworthy. Somebody give me one or two more.
Tolerant.
Okay. Forgiving, that's a good one to have in a friend or in a spouse. You want to have that. Okay, that's a nice list. Very different from the list that we see here in the Sermon on the Mount. And besides, what is Jesus really saying here in this? This is the question I want to put to you. Is Jesus saying the blessed person has these eight traits? They're poor, they mourn, they're meek, they don't assert themselves, they hunger and thirst for righteousness, they're a peacemaker, they're pure in heart, they're merciful, and they're persecuted. So he's saying, go get those eight traits. Go find them. Okay, your job for next week is to analyze the unity. What does God really seek? And don't look at your syllabus in advance. Figure it out yourself. What is the picture? What is the... You tell me, what's the story? What's the picture that Christ seeks in those Beatitudes? It's a description of the life, the character, the nature, the constitution of the blessed person. But is he just saying, here, go get these eight... Like we'd say, here, you know, I want to be more compassionate, more honest, more reliable, more trustworthy. I want to be a Boy Scout. You know? Thrifty, wise, and brave. Or is there something else going on here? That's the riddle I put to you. See you next week.